Foresight. My name is Muhammad. Today, I'm going to read to you the English translation of an excerpt from Munajatul Arifin. Please stay with me. أنا العبد الفقير وأنا أعيش وصاحب القلق نهاري دونكم ليل. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. My God, how agreeable for hearts are the thoughts inspiring your remembrance. How sweet traveling to you through imagination upon the roads of the unseen worlds. How pleasant the taste of your love. How delightful the drink of your nearness. So give us refuge from your casting out and you sending far, and place us among the most elect of your knowers, the most righteous of your servants, the most truthful of your obeyers, the most sincere of your worshippers. O Almighty, O Majestic, O Generous, O Endower, by your mercy and kindness, O Most Merciful of the Merciful.
Welcome back, dear listeners. We were talking about a heart at peace and how this heart is such an integral part of our existence. Of course, a heart which both can lead us towards goodness and righteousness, and unfortunately, a heart which can lead us towards rebellion and arrogance. So just as we have just said in this very short intro, the heart is something which can lead us towards the heights of perfection and towards the greatest summits of the love for Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted. But at the same time, this very heart can take us to the depths of arrogance and pride and greed and jealousy. So we must be very careful, dear friends, in this path of ubudiyyah, in this path of the servitude to Allah, and in this path of the obedience and worship to Allah. We must be very careful that this heart is an integral part of this worship and this ubudiyyah. If our heart is not involved in the prayers and the du'as and the supplications and the litanies, then these du'as and prayers and salah and even recitation of the Qur'an and the recitation of the various du'as, they merely remain upon our lips and our tongues. And truly, in the overall aspect of things and when considering all different things, if this worship and this ubudiyyah and this servitude and these du'as and these prayers and these things remain upon our lips, then truly what a waste of a life where these things only remain upon our tongues and they do not infiltrate into the depths of our heart. It is not merely the tongue which needs to move back and forth, up and down, when speaking to the Almighty of Allah. Rather, it is the depths of the heart which must move up and down in the remembrance and in the praise of the Exalted, the Mighty, the Allah.
Ya Allah, Ya Allah, Ya Allah, Ya Allah, Ya Mannan,
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is parstoday.com.
Ya Allah, Ya Rahman, haqqiq amanina, waffiqna fi kulli an fi ma sa'ina. Ya Allah, Ya Mannan, haqqiq amanina.
Sorry, you know. أجب دعائي يا رجائي للرضا والخير أنر طريقي مع صديقي باحترام الغير.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Today we're on the streets of Melbourne talking to people to see just how much they really know about Islam. So what do you know about Islam?
I live in a predominantly white area, so I don't know a whole lot, but I do like to think of myself as well kind of learned in that kind of area.
Very little, pretty much nothing. I know that it's a religion.
Yeah, you know that it's a religion?
Yeah.
Not much, to be honest. I'm not very religious myself, but I know that the public eye is being changed to, you know, look at them differently.
Yeah.
In my eyes, it's, I don't know, it's just a bit confusing. Yeah.
It's a religion?
Yep.
What do I know about it? Yeah, they've got the Quran, which is like their Bible.
Yep.
They got Ramadan. This level. And yeah, I really don't know that much about it, I guess.
Mm. Yeah. Do you know that it's a religion of peace, and it's not obviously how the media portrays it to be?
Yeah.
Oh, like the bad stuff, really?
Yeah.
Not really any good stuff about it.
Yeah.
Just what the news shows us.
Yeah. Well, that is the negative propaganda that we're here to clear, man. Yeah. So. Yeah, basically, Islam's just a religion of peace. Basically, we're taught that we're not allowed to kill any innocent people.
Yeah,
that's completely against the religion. If you do kill any innocent people, you go straight to hell. So basically, everything that that's happening in the name of Islam is false. So, you know, people would associate anything with, like, anyone they want to, you know. Do you know what Ramadan is?
Yeah, I do. It's the month of fasting.
It's the month of fasting?
I just know it's when Islamic people, they fast for a week, is that right?
A month.
Month, okay. I know, yeah, just about that, but I don't understand anything behind it.
It's like fasting or something like that, yeah.
Yeah, so Muslims fast for a month. Yeah, so we fast for 30 days, 29 days, according to the lunar calendar, the moon. The Islamic calendar. And so basically, yeah, we just fast for 30 days. We try to get closer to God and that kind of thing in those 30 days. Do you know where Mecca is?
I believe it's in Jerusalem. I could be wrong.
It's in Saudi Arabia.
Okay.
No. I know it's... Is it like north or something? I don't know. I know it's in a certain place.
It is actually north, northwest.
Yeah?
Yeah, but it's in Saudi Arabia.
Mecca is in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
Never heard of it.
Mecca is a city in Saudi Arabia. It's got the Kaaba in there. It's a place where Muslims go for pilgrimage. You're supposed to go once in your lifetime, if you're able, if you have the means, if you're not, you know, if you don't have an injury or that kind of thing. Do you know if Muslims believe in Jesus?
I think that they don't, but I'm not too positive on the actual truth of that. So,
as I said before, I'm not very religious, but I wouldn't. Yeah, I don't really look into that much. All I see is, you know, the propaganda, as you said before, in the news stories. But yeah, I don't personally. I don't dive into all the facts behind it. So,
I think Jesus is. I'm not actually sure, but I thought he may be one of the prophets, or is it?
That is very correct. Yeah.
I reckon some of them would.
Yeah.
Like, well, maybe not all of them.
Yeah. Well, all Muslims are taught that we have to believe in Jesus. We believe that Jesus was a messenger of God, and we believe that the Bible was revealed to him. We don't believe that he's the Son of God or that he's a God himself.
Yeah.
Yeah. We believe that there is only one God, and there are no partners associated with him.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Foresight. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode and another great tip. في امان الله, and God bless you all.
لا إله سواه لا تخالطه الظنون ولا العيون تراه الله جل في علاه هو أنسي وملاذي أحتمي بحماه حسبنا الله ونعم الوكيل نعم المولى ونعم النصير حسبنا الله ونعم الوكيل نعم المولى ونعم النصير حسبنا الله حسبنا الله حسبنا الله
يوسف جلالي بتهران
Rubashavit Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Sayed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
On Wednesday morning, Palestinians woke up to the tragic news of the brutal killing of Al Jazeera journalist Shireen Abu Akleh in the Jenin refugee camp. Abu Akleh was killed after being shot in the head while covering Israeli army raids in the northern occupied West Bank. Her killing drew angry reactions and condemnations in Palestine and around the world. Palestinian resistance groups, including Hamas and the Islamic Jihad, condemned in the strongest terms Israel's killing of the Palestinian journalist.
The Zionist enemy killed Shireen in cold blood in another example of their brutality against Palestinians. Killing her exposes the violent and criminal nature of the Zionist regime. We condemn this brutal crime and we demand that the Zionist regime and its leaders be brought to justice for their crimes.
Shireen Abu Akleh's extrajudicial killing is further evidence of a trend by Israeli regime forces to systematically attack journalists. During the 11-day war in 2021, Israeli warplanes bombed several buildings in Gaza, housing media companies and news channels.
The Zionist regime attacks journalists in order to silence them and to hide the truth. By targeting Palestinian journalists, the Zionist regime wants to terrorize us and stop us from exposing its war crimes to the world. The Zionist regime doesn't want us to show its ugly face.
Statistics show that Israeli regime forces have killed some 50 Palestinian journalists during the last 22 years. During the Great March of Return, Israeli snipers shot and killed two Gazan journalists and injured dozens more.
This is not the first time Israeli armed forces has targeted Palestinian journalists. They have targeted a number of them during the Great March of Return in 2018. And this is also another addition to Israeli illegal practices against Palestinian journalists by killing Shireen Abu Akleh, one of the most famous journalists in the Palestinian territories. Israel is trying to kill the truth.
Experts say Israeli forces will continue with their violations against journalists as long as the international community keeps turning a blind eye. Israeli forces have been increasingly attacking journalists in recent years. Palestinian journalists risk their lives on a daily basis to cover the news and expose the brutality of the Israeli regime. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
With every candle symbolizing the path she lit, activists and journalists gathered in front of the Embassy of Palestine in Tehran, not just to condemn her killing by an Israeli sniper, but to show the world that Shireen Abu Akleh's footsteps will be followed. Al Jazeera's 51-year-old journalist was targeted on assignment while wearing a press jacket that made it easy for her to be identified as a journalist.
The policies of our Zionist enemies has always been clear. They are against anyone who unveils the reality on the ground. The killing of a well-known journalist like Shireen shows that they obviously don't want the world to know the truth about Palestine.
We lost a dear colleague who was killed on assignment. This is a sad day for journalists all over the world. What makes it even more tragic is that she was not even in a war zone. This proves that freedom of speech and human rights means nothing to the Zionist regime.
The Palestinian journalist was also a citizen of the United States, and many are now asking why the U.S. is silent about what they can only describe as blatant murder. Shirin was a veteran journalist and very well known, too. Obviously, the Israeli regime does not want the world to know about its crimes, and that's why they silenced her.
Well, this shows the cruelty of the Israeli regime. As you can see, if we see such an act in other countries, we may face with a strong reaction by the Western governments and also Western media. But today, inside occupied Palestine, we have seen one of the most cruel scenes that could be possible. An Israeli soldier attacked a journalist and killed him in front of the camera. And this shows that, unfortunately, by the double standards of the Western governments and also Western medias, Israeli governments can continue to kill and assassinate everyone. And this is completely against the freedom of speech and the freedom of the Palestinian people.
Shireen Abu Akleh was covering the Israeli forces raid on the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank on Wednesday. The veteran television correspondent was a household name across the Arab world for her bold coverage of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
The tragic event has sparked outrage in Iran as well as other parts of the world. Those who have gathered in front of the Palestinian embassy in Tehran are calling for impunity for Israel to end. Gisumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
Following the killing of Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Akleh, Yemeni journalists have gathered in front of the Palestinian embassy in Sana'a to denounce Israeli crimes against Palestinian journalists and media activists.
The Yemeni Journalists Union condemns what has happened to Shirin Abu Akleh and her colleague. They were directly targeted by Israeli forces while wearing a press vest to ensure protection in the areas of conflict based on international conventions. Her killing is a flagrant violation of international law. We call on all media activists around the world to express solidarity with Abu Akleh and other colleagues in Palestine.
The Yemeni media activists denounced in the strongest terms the targeted killing of Abu Akleh by Israeli forces as she was covering an Israeli raid in the occupied West Bank.
The news of the martyrdom of Shirin was shocking, and the whole world is shocked because she was a powerful and influential figure and was able to represent a strong voice. The killing of Shirin is a turning point and the beginning of a new phase, and her blood will have a significant impact, God willing, in pushing the free people to move against the Zionist project.
Abu Akleh was a veteran Palestinian journalist for the Qatar-based Al Jazeera television news network. She was hit by a live bullet while covering an Israeli raid in the city of Jenin while wearing a press vest.
Yemeni journalists say Shirin Abu Akleh will always remain a symbol of courage for all the free journalists around the world who stand against oppression, whatever it takes. They say Abu Akleh's killing is a blatant violation of international law on the protection of journalists.
Some say the recent election changes everything, others say it doesn't. But it has changed a century of unionist political dominance.
The state was founded on the basis of a gerrymandered sectarian headcount, where it was believed there would be a permanent and perpetual unionist majority. Nationalists and Republicans were never intended or expected to get the top political job here.
The election has complicated Northern Ireland's existing problems. Sinn Féin nationalists' victory a step towards a future United Ireland, a blow to the Unionists, with the Democratic Unionists' party threatening to boycott the Stormont Assembly over a post-Brexit sea border for trade that they say undermines Northern Ireland's position in the United Kingdom.
Among the things that remain to be changed, this reminder of the decades-old sectarian divide, a wall separating communities as it has done through decades of troubles and peace. We tried to speak to people on the unionist side of it to no avail. But real change seems happening in the center. The Alliance Party has doubled its vote share among those who want to increase awareness. Cross-community efforts like those here may speak of a younger generation's desire to understand each other, regardless of which side they're on. And this is not the only center forging such ties, and they're all moving in the same direction.
So the purpose of this is trying to normalize interactions between both communities, to show young people that the culture and identity of those people based on the other side of the wall is no threat to their own culture and identity. And then a copper fastens their sense of culture, identity and space that makes it harder to feel threatened by others.
But while those threats remain, it is clear that there is a middle ground growing, thanks to these nascent cross-community ties. Saeed Puriza, Belfast, Northern Ireland.
Many believe the crime of sexually abusing a child is even more heinous than murder. The EU's executive arm, the European Commission, says 85 million child sex abuse videos and images were identified by the bloc's authorities last year, a record number.
In the EU, the reports related to the European Union, the member states, have increased with 6,000% the last 10 years. Why is this increasing? Of course, nobody knows for sure.
The Commission says it's not known exactly why these crimes are on the rise, but analysts say the EU has been allowed to expand too quickly, with some nations harbouring criminal gangs.
And now, of course, thanks to or due to open borders, are these criminal networks, they started to flourish and integrate further.
The EU Commission is proposing to establish a new agency designed to prevent child sex abuse and support victims.
At least one in five children falls victim to sexual violence during childhood in Europe. So these numbers are really embarrassing.
Anti-trafficking agencies say 2 million children recently entered the EU having fled the conflict in Ukraine, many of them unaccompanied. Gangs and individuals see an opportunity for exploitation.
The police and child protection services need to work together, plus they need to work together across borders, and there need to be better information sharing platforms.
The European Commission has a message for predators.
We are coming for you.
But critics are asking why more has not been done up to now. Given that it promotes itself as a project designed to protect and improve the lives of citizens, rights groups say this issue seriously undermines the credibility of the European Union. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Palestinian reporter Shirin Abu Akleh was shot while covering an Israeli raid on the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. The veteran reporter who worked for Al Jazeera's Arab language channel was shot in the face by Israeli forces despite wearing a blue flak jacket clearly marked with press. Israeli officials claim Palestinians may be responsible for the death of the 51-year-old journalist. But another reporter accompanying Abu Akleh, who was also shot in the back, rejected the Israeli claim as a lie.
The occupation is murderous and criminal. They shot us for no reason. We were shocked by the shooting. I was lucky and I turned my back when the first bullet was shot and injured my back. They wanted to kill me. I was injured in my back and the second bullet shot my colleague Shirin and caused her death. There were no armed people and we cannot put our lives in danger and say the wrong narrative. The Israeli army is a liar and criminal and despicable.
Al Jazeera also said Abu Akleh was assassinated in cold blood and urged the international community to hold Israeli forces responsible. The Palestinian Authority said Abu Akleh's killing is a heinous crime and part of the occupation's policy of targeting journalists to obscure the truth and commit crimes silently. In Gaza, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas described the killing as a new crime against journalism in Palestine, while the Islamic Jihad movement branded it an unsuccessful attempt to cover up realities. The journalist's murder also drew widespread condemnation from countries across the world, such as Iran, Pakistan, and Belgium. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman, Saeed Khatibzadeh, called Abu Akleh's killing a deliberate and criminal act. The United Nations called for an immediate and thorough investigation and for those responsible to be held accountable, a request that was echoed by the European Union.
We immediately called for a swift and independent investigation so that the perpetrators of this terrible crime can be brought to justice.
The International Federation of Journalists said it would submit Abu Akleh's case to the International Criminal Court. Abu Akleh's murder is just the tip of the iceberg of crimes committed by Israel against journalists. Reporters Without Borders say nearly 150 Palestinian journalists have been wounded by Israeli forces across the Gaza Strip and the West Bank since 2018. Israeli strikes also destroyed a building housing local offices of media outlets during its last year's war on Gaza. Such atrocity, along with frequent raids and shootings in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, show that the Israeli regime has no scruples about murdering unarmed Palestinians. The silence of the international community is also seen as a green light for Israel to continue such crimes.
A year ago, Israeli regime forces bombed hundreds of buildings in the Gaza Strip during the 11-day war, also known as the Sword of Al-Quds Battle. The wanton Israeli attacks claimed the lives of over 260 Palestinians, including scores of children and women. The Gaza-based resistance groups Mili Hamas, the Islamic Jihad, and the Popular Resistance Committees also fired some 4,000 rockets towards the Israeli-occupied territories during the 11-day war. The Sword of Al-Quds battle began when Hamas's Izzeddin al-Qassam brigades attacked the Israeli regime in retaliation to Israeli attacks on Palestinians in Al-Quds' Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. Overwhelmed by the significantly developed military capabilities of Palestinian resistance factions, the Israeli regime was forced to announce a unilateral ceasefire.
During the Sword of Al-Quds battle, Palestinian resistance factions fired thousands of rockets against the Zionist regime, forcing it to desperately call for a ceasefire after 11 days. The resistance is prepared to respond to any aggression, and nowadays the military capabilities of the resistance are better than last year. The Zionist enemy must understand that attacking Al-Quds will result in a new war.
The 11-day war saw the heaviest fighting between Gaza resistance factions and Israeli regime forces since 2014. Over the past decade, Palestinian resistance factions in Gaza have been boosting their production capacity for homemade rockets and drones. During the May war, Israel's Iron Dome also proved to be a failure. The multi-million-dollar high-tech missile system was unable to protect the Israeli regime.
During the 11-day war last year, 2021, Hamas and the Palestinians scored very well against Israel in a number of things. One is the launching of rockets against Israel closed very much Israeli airports, port, and the Israeli business community. In addition to that, the Palestinians succeeded in unifying all fronts.
The Israeli regime has waged four wars on the Gaza Strip since 2007 under the watchful eye of the international community.
Experts believe in any future war, the Israeli regime will be dealt a heavy blow by Palestinian resistance groups in the Gaza Strip. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Representatives from 55 countries and 22 international organizations gathered in Brussels on Tuesday to raise money for Syrians impacted by more than a decade of conflict.
The total pledge amounts to 6.4 billion euros.
Aid agencies say that amount pales into insignificance when compared to the colossal amount of money the West continues to pump into the Ukrainian army, not to mention the cost of taking in a huge number of Ukrainian refugees. Rights groups point out that 7 million Syrian refugees fled to neighbouring countries while the EU closed its borders to them during the past 11 years. Recently, within weeks, the EU welcomed 5 million Ukrainian refugees. For the first time, Russia was not invited to the annual fundraising conference for Syria in Brussels. Moscow was even singled out for blame.
The Russian war will increase food and energy prices, and the situation in Syria will become worst.
Critics say it was in fact the US and its EU allies that tore Syria apart and then turned their backs on the Syrian people. The West tried in vain for years to oust Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Russia should have been invited to the Brussels conference, it suggested. Analysts say Vladimir Putin's address delivered last Monday was moderate in tone.
So maybe this is the momentum which needs to be seized by the Americans, by the European Union, and say, okay, we have to figure this out. Let's see that we can talk.
Delegates heard how 90% of people in Syria are living in poverty. Groups like Oxfam and Save the Children say all the financial pledges made must be kept. That has not happened in previous years. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Opposition leader Keir Starmer has been at the front of the chorus urging Prime Minister Boris Johnson to do the decent thing and step down after being fined for his part in a series of lockdown gatherings dubbed Partygate. Now the Labour leader has become embroiled in a controversy of his own, nicknamed Currygate, after being pictured enjoying a meal and a drink in what the party's calling a work event, but one being dubbed an illegal gathering by his opponents.
First and foremost, no rules were broken. I don't actually believe that those that are accusing me believe rules were broken. They are trying to simply drag all politicians into a place where the public think we're all the same. For me, this is an in-principle position. No rules are broken. I'm absolutely clear about that. But in the event that I'm wrong about that and I get a fixed penalty notice, I will do the right thing and step down.
Political observers think this is a risky strategy.
Well, I think that his advisers think this is a really good ploy to contrast him with Boris Johnson, who, of course, didn't resign, having been fined for breaking the lockdown regulations. But it's a dangerous ploy as well, because he's not in control of what the police investigation is going to find. And if he does get fined, he's now been committed to resigning as leadership of the Labour Party.
The Labour Party had desperately wanted to take the moral high ground when it came to their handling of COVID rules and regulations, not just in the House of Commons, but in the court of public opinion. But now with their leader caught in the spotlight because of his own missteps, supporters of Boris Johnson are hoping to capitalise on this political mistake and make Labour pay. Whether or not the leader of the Labour Party is fined, for many of the electorate, this is yet another letdown. Politicians who seemingly are unwilling or unable to play by the rules. The police investigation could take as long as a month to conclude. Now Labour and its leader must play the waiting game and cross their political fingers that this high-stake gamble has paid off. Mina Taylor, London.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we're going to be examining a question, and that question is related to the topic of intercession or shifa'at, which is an Islamic concept, a Quranic concept. For some of our regular listeners, they know that we have covered this topic previously in some of our previous sessions in detail. And those listeners who were listening to those sessions, they benefited from them. For those of you who haven't, you can refer to the archives and listen to them and benefit from them. But the question we want to ask today is this: exactly when does this intercession and shafa'at occur? Fortunately, we have a hadith and a narration from the Holy Prophet, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, in which the Prophet Muhammad kind of enumerates the different places in which this shafa'at and intercession will occur by these holy personalities, such as primarily the the Prophet of God, the family of the Prophet, the Imams alayhi wasalam, and other people as well, because we know that Shafa'at is not something that is limited to infallibles. Rather, other people will also have this distinction as well. The Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wasalam said, "My friends and my family will be beneficial in seven places which are very dangerous and frightening." Seven very frightening and dangerous places. And the Prophet enumerates them. Let's listen to the Prophet Muhammad's hadith and learn what these places are. The first is at the time of death, when the person is dying and his spirit is exiting his body. The second is in the grave, when after a person dies and his body is transferred to the grave. At this time, this is a very dangerous time, and these people, these great personalities, will intercede on a person's behalf. The third is at the time when the Qiyamah will begin, the resurrection begins, and a person will be raised from his grave. A very, very dangerous and a very frightening time. Right? At this time, the intercession of these holy persons will be beneficial. The fourth is the time when a person will receive the letter and the book of his actions, right? When a person will be given the book of his actions by God in his hand, this is a very, very nervous, a person would be very nervous and frightened at that time. The intercession of these holy persons will be a benefit. The fifth is during the time when a person's actions will be assessed and calculated and weighed. The sixth is during the time when a person is standing near the scales in which his actions are weighed. This is also kind of connected to the previous one. Finally, the seventh place, which is very, very dangerous and a very, very frightening time, is the time when a person is passing the bridge, the sirat. These are all the different mawaqif or way stations of the hereafter, beginning with death until passing over the bridge. At these times, the intercession of these people will be very beneficial. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the different places where the intercession will be beneficial. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In Britain, almost two-thirds of tenants over the age of 65 have cut back on their general spending, as a result of the cost of living crisis, and campaigners are warning that older people who do not own their homes are particularly vulnerable to rising fuel bills. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Hilary Osborne. The piece is titled, Older UK Renters Forced to Cut Back on Spending as Living Costs Soar. In Britain, almost two-thirds of tenants over the age of 65 have cut back on their general spending as a result of the cost of living crisis, and campaigners are warning that older people who do not own their homes are particularly vulnerable to rising electricity and fuel bills. Research shared with Guardian Money by the charity Independent Age puts the spotlight on the struggles of older tenants who are battling to keep up with rising household costs. Its survey found that 62% of renters over the age of 65 were having to cut back on their general spending, and that they were more likely to be doing so than their contemporaries who were homeowners. A quarter said they would not be able to afford a £10 a month increase in their living costs, while 71% said they would not be able to cover a £50 rise. More than half said they felt anxious about their finances. The state's pension increased by 3.1% last month, well below the 7% inflation rate recorded in March. Energy bills went up at the same time, and with a further increase likely this October, economists have predicted inflation could go above 10% before the end of the year. Older private renters are particularly vulnerable to soaring inflation, particularly where rents have been rising too, says Dan Wilson-Craw, the deputy director of the campaign group Generation Rent. Unlike homeowners who are likely to have paid off their mortgage, they still have housing costs. If landlords want to raise the rent to reflect the wider market, there is little current tenants can do. For retirees on fixed incomes, this cuts their disposable income or forces them to move. Independent Age's survey of 2,000 adults in England over the age of 65, of whom 391 were renting, found that 57% of tenants were cutting back on heating. 42% said they had reduced how much food and drink they were buying. And 29% were buying less vehicle fuel. Aside from those most essential purchases, 46% said that they had cut back on clothing and on footwear purchase, and 39% had reduced their social activities. Separate figures from Shelter show that between the financial years of 2020-2021 and 2021-2022, there was a 20% increase in the number of over-65s contacting its helpline who were at risk of homelessness. Francisca, a 64-year-old, and her husband Colin, a 70-year-old, say their rent has risen by more than 7% this year. They are struggling to cover it and the other bills they face, despite making cutbacks. When we go to the supermarket, we are buying the cheapest of the cheap, she says. We're taking fewer baths, fewer showers. We turn the lights off. Even on cold days, we turn the heating off. Although the couple chose to rent because, says Francisca, we're not sure what the future holds, she says it has left them vulnerable. They have lived in poor housing in the past while paying a high rent. We're evicted through a Section 21 no-fault eviction by one previous landlord, and have also had problems with letting agencies. This has made them very nervous about what happens when their contract ends next March. Their age has financial implications. At our stage of life, we have a pot of money, and if we live a long life, we have to stretch it over that time, she says. We can't go to work 9 to 5 or get new careers, so we rely on freelancing. Morgan Vine, the Independent Age head of policy, says older renters are left in increasingly precarious financial situations and need help and protection from the government. Our research found that older renters are one of the most at-risk groups of dropping into poverty past state pension age and are more likely to experience long-term poverty, she says. Day-to-day, we also know older renters are at an increased risk of living in poor quality homes and face higher costs and greater financial insecurity than other groups as a result. Morgan Vine says older renters have shared concerns with the charity about high rents and that their landlords could sell up at any time. With the cost of living crisis squeezing people's budgets from every angle, these worries are only going to get worse, she says. Renters make up the minority of households in England, with a head aged 65 or over, according to the latest official figures. The latest data shows there are 5.5 million owner-occupiers in this age range and 5.1 million own their home outright, which means no monthly mortgage costs. There are only 382,000 households in the private sector headed by an older person and 1 million in the social rented sector. Housing associations are allowed to put up rents by 4.1% in April, and many tenants who rent from them have seen increases. In the private rented sector, it is not easy to see what is happening to existing tenancies, but newly advertised contracts are typically costing more than a year ago. Polly Neat, the chief executive of Shelter, says older tenants are likely to be on low incomes, which would mean pressure from rising costs. With bills skyrocketing and private rents the highest on record, it's no wonder our emergency helpline is picking up the phone to older renters who, instead of preparing for retirement, are facing homelessness. No one should be forced to choose between eating or paying their rent, she says. Wilson Crawl says the state pension has risen by less than inflation, but it's worse for private renters relying on housing benefit, which has been frozen since 2020. If these people are paying higher rents, that money could be coming out of the rest of their income, and that's before we even think about rising energy prices. Wilson Crowe adds, we need a freeze on rents and another suspension of evictions to protect tenants during this crisis.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Dear listeners of this program Lantern, thank you very much for joining us. The title of today's story in this part is The Duck and the Oyster. There was once a duck who was very fond of eggs. She visited the hen house very often and at the last got so greedy that he would swallow the eggs whole. One day the duck wandered down to the seashore. There he spied an oyster. In a twinkling, the oyster was resting in the dog's stomach, shell and all. It pained the dog a good deal. As you can guess, I've learned that all round things are not eggs, he said groaning, act in haste and repent at leisure, and often in pain. Dr. Fakhr Rohani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In this episode, we are going to talk about being in a hurry or hurriedness. Hurry or being in a hurry or hurriedness, these characteristics are among some moral traits that are not good and unacceptable. One of the characteristics of those people who is treated rather in an unfriendly way in the Holy Quran is being in a hurry. Because of this, we find that some people later on feel remorse and they are really repentant of what they had done because of being in a hurry. In the Holy Quran, we find that the infidels and hypocrites are those people whom deserve to be punished. However, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala never punishes them here in this world. Rather, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gives them respite so that perhaps they would correct themselves or they might be directed to the right path. And at the same time, they may be in such a position and not to be punished so fast, so that they might take lessons or they might be instructed in one way or another and they might correct themselves. At the same time, we find that as a human being, there are many stressful situations, and in certain stressful situations, people are usually in a hurry. At the same time, for example, the need to reach some material needs or answering some desires they might need, being in a hurry. Now we find that there are certain moral characteristics that are being paid attention in the Holy Quran. Some of them are, for example, forgetfulness, or some of them are, heedlessness, or being in a hurry, as indicated in the Surah Al-Isra, verse number 11, being ignorant, or ignorance, are among the characteristics indicated in the Surah Al-Ahzab, verse 72. Now we find that in the Holy Quran, we can find that being in a hurry means reaching the desired destination ahead of its time or very much in anticipation of its due time. This is what's indicated in the book Mufradat Al-Fad Al-Quran Al-Karim, which is a Quranic lexicon, a lexicon of Quranic terms, as developed by the late Quranic scholar Raghib Al-Isfahani, under the entry Ajal, Ain Jim Lam.
Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
For example, in these indications, we find that in the Holy Quran, it's indicated in the Surah Al-Isra and in the Surah Al-Anbiya. It's indicated that being in a hurry is a characteristic indicated and already embodied and indicated in human beings. Hence, nobody can ignore it or overlook it. However, people are expected to train themselves, or, for example, children are expected to be trained and to be taught, and not to be very much in a hurry. And they must be able to control and to curb those characteristics. And now we find that in the Holy Quran, being in a hurry is one of the abominable characteristics, abominable moral traits. And especially, this is especially very much frowned upon when they come to be connected with material needs or answering some base desires in human beings. Evidence in regard to this and in support of these characteristics can be found in the following places in the Holy Quran, in the Surah Yunus, verse number 50, in the Surah Ash-Shu'ara, verses 200 and 204, in the Surah Safat, verses 175 and 76. Now, what's indicated here in this connection is that the Holy Quran, as indicated in the Surah Al-Kahf, verse 68, or the Surah Al-Anbiya, verses 38 and 39, it's indicated that being in a hurry, or hurriedness, can be regarded as those moral virtues, or as those moral traits, that should be curbed and should be controlled. We know that sometimes we may have delayed in doing some of the businesses or jobs that we are expected to fulfill or carry out. Now, with because of any problem or owing to certain problems, we may not be successful to do everything on time. Because of this, in order to compensate and in order not to fall behind our schedule or schedule, we usually make haste. However, in contrast to or the opposite point of making haste is being patient and patience. In this regard, we find that making haste in order to do something without all the requirements be ready and without the appropriate time to arrive is morally an abominated moral trait. It means that so long as a condition isn't that ready for us to do something, we shouldn't make haste to carry it out because, prior to any proper condition, we may not receive any good result. Making haste is an undesirable trait sometimes noticed in the conduct of other people. And at the same time, we find that, on the other hand, patience or sabr is a good moral characteristic, is a good moral trait, to which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala invites everybody in the Holy Quran. Especially Muslims and believers are expected to be able to make it institutionalized in themselves to be patient people. Patience in this sense means being watchful for a good opportunity for the ripe time to come, and not making haste, in effect of which some other earlier opportunities may turn null and void. Thank you.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah. Ala bi dhikrillahi
tatma'innul qulub. Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.